It's Catherine Austin Fitz, who's joining us for the rest of the evening, who jumped in because our originally scheduled guest about the Great Lakes water wars, which are kind of been going on for a while and are going to be happening even more, perhaps, in the years ahead if these drought conditions continue in the United States and many other regions in the U.S. Keep looking at all of that fresh water and thinking that they deserve that where they are too. And this is a real problem, obviously, for shipping in the Great Lakes, and that there has been a history of lakes that have been drained until they're merely mud beds, just so that the places that needed the water the most had what they needed when they wanted it, because they had more political power to get it than the people that were parked on that water. And had been for many years. And so the fight will be going on, and we'll revisit the conversation at some point. Our guest originally scheduled for tonight, though, had a death in his family. So we'll take a look at that later on. I had a death in mine, and the loss of my dog, Diz, Dizraeli. We name all of our pets after British prime ministers. And Diz had been affected by the pet food recall from last spring. The imported Chinese pet food that had been processed using what was tantamount to a kind of poison. And this is ultimately what killed him, although it was not as fast as other dogs had died. His kidneys just never fully recovered. And as a result, he just kept losing, weight by the ounce every week since then until his original body weight of 18 pounds was down to just 8. When we finally had to have him put to sleep. And I want to ask Catherine Austin Fitz about this. Just another few days, another story about poison imports coming into the United States. I was just curious where what she hears in that story, maybe that we're missing too. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Anyway, if you go online to coasttocoastam.com, you can link up to my blog, and there is tonight's crypto news plus a few more details about my dog, including some photos of the little hero and of the porch where we had had to put him to sleep earlier this week. And you can see the fireplace that I was just sitting by a few minutes ago before I came into work to do the notes for tonight's show. So, Catherine, let me throw that at you. It seems like that's sort of a something we keep hearing a lot about is whether it's the lead paint on children's toys or products that are being imported from China. That have, some sort of level of toxicity to it. What do you hear in that? I mean, is that just a weird coincidence, and it's just that it keeps being China, and we should not think of it as anything more than that?
And I've never researched the individual cases because that it does, part of economic warfare is, in fact, those kinds of situations. But we are in a long-term transition from having centralized control work through energy to centralized control work through food and water. And as part of that, you're seeing constant articles and drumbeats about food safety that are used to ensure more centralized control of food. So, whenever I hear a food safety story, I'm always very suspicious.
That it's going to mean what, another government agency or?
More rules that will benefit the large provider.
Okay,
So, for
I see.
example, I have an article about the National Animal Identification System, NAIS, and the application of digital technology, in essence, to the all livestock, and the extent to which that puts the small farmer at tremendous disadvantage and gives amazing control potentially to the federal government. So, anything that increases centralized control generally works against both markets and freedom.
Well, if we're talking about the internet and centralized control, I go back to a question from the first hour. Somebody said they're very concerned about all of these websites and stories that are almost exclusively on the internet, by the way, showing these large, in some cases, outdoor tent-based prisons that are being thrown up by the U.S. government being ready to warehouse people. Where are you with that?
I don't know anything about it. I've never seen one. I can, if we're dealing in a situation where the financial system is very unstable, and I can see why a government would be concerned over issues of massive immigration or what would happen if law and order broke down, but I really don't know.
Okay. I'm with you on that. I think that's generally, I don't know either, and I keep getting conflicting information about it, so I'll hold that open for now. Now, but back to what we were talking about, which is the devaluation of the dollar this week. Explain to me, because I'm the dumbest guy I know, what does that mean? And like, how can who decided that the dollar is worth less? Doesn't the dollar decide? I mean, doesn't the market decide? What happened?
No,
what's the story?
The military decides. if tomorrow our military and nuclear capacity and various invisible weaponry went away, the dollar would reprice to about 10 cents on the dollar. Most of the dollar's value comes from its the fact that it is so large, everybody's in it. So it's the reserve, or it has been the reserve currency. But we also have the ability through both covert and overt warfare to force our will on people. So, for example, when I hear a country threatened, what I hear is, not the threats that are in the paper, but if you don't buy more treasury securities, this and this and this is going to happen to you. So we're watching the perfect fusion of economic, political, and military warfare into one.
Well,
the value of our treasury securities and the value of our currency at this point are highly dependent on force and our military capacity.
So then how did the dollar get devalued?
Well, the dollar is dropping in value because our financial situation is the U.S. government is essentially bankrupt. Now, I'm being imprecise to say that because for 10 years the federal government has refused to produce audited financial statements, and I believe that there's very good sort of indications to indicate that the finances that they are publishing are very different than what is actually going on. So we don't have reliable financial information about the federal government finances, but even what exists indicates that it's bankrupt. So we're borrowing tremendous amounts every day to keep spending money on things that don't create any productivity whatsoever. And we now have an economy, the economy of every county in this country is deeply dependent on financial flows from the federal government. To give you an example, if you look at the municipalities across the country, we have municipal governments that are very dependent on the flow of property taxes and fees from, essentially from real estate transactions. And as the housing bubble slows down, that's going to ramp down. And then they're very dependent for federal flows. And those monies come from borrowing money. And as the dollar drops, the cost of borrowing that money is going to skyrocket. And it's even possible to conjecture that it's not possible to borrow that money. The world's not willing to provide that money forever. We're literally in a situation where the red button may be pushed.
I saw a story about how, I think it was Los Angeles, had seen their city revenues go down for speeding offenses, for traffic offenses, because of the traffic cameras that went up. That the traffic cameras went up, and they wrote a certain number of tickets for the, for going through the red lights and stuff. But then afterward, what they noticed was just people started actually following the street lights, and they knew they were on camera, so they slowed down. Now now they're going to have to come up with the money that they're losing from the revenue from having put up the cameras. And it's causing somewhat of a crunch because now they weren't somehow expecting that they'd be getting less money from putting the cameras up, and that's right. Sort of the law of unintended consequences. I don't know what it's a metaphor for, but it seemed like a really good metaphor. I just didn't know for what. It sort of seemed typical somehow of short-sighted government work when it came to money, and that it seemed like a lack of integrity on the part of that they weren't being about just one thing. That if we're only about getting people to slow down and obey the law, shouldn't they be dancing a jig that they don't have the kind of revenues they had from the speeding tickets?
Well, but
they're not.
We're increasingly building an economy where we make money from other people's failures as opposed to other people's successes.
Well, this is good. This is the metaphor I was looking for. So tell me what
I use the Popsicle Index. Do you remember the Popsicle Index?
Right. Right.
The Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a community who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a Popsicle, and come home alone safely. So when I was a little girl, the Popsicle Index in West Philadelphia was 100%. It was unthinkable a child couldn't run up to Spruce Street, buy a Popsicle, and come home alone. And the Dow Jones was, at that time, about 150 to 500. So the Dow Jones is now over 13,000, and the Popsicle Index in my old neighborhood is much lower.
Well, yeah, because people even... And maybe it's true that you can't safely send a child up to get a Popsicle and come back, but there's a perception even in small towns in middle America where the child is still almost guaranteed 100% return, where the Popsicle Index may be 60 or 50%.
I live in a beautiful little town, and the Popsicle Index is certainly not 100% here.
Right. What do you think it is in middle Tennessee where people are really relatively safe from anybody driving through and taking their child?
I think from what I see here and across the country, but it's true here, but it's everywhere, kids aren't safe here for a variety of reasons. One big one is the drugs. There are very significant drug business presence, and as a result, you have gangs and you have a whole culture which really is not safe for kids. Huh. So I would say the number one problem in terms of safety is drugs and drug gangs, or, throughout rural America, wherever I've been.
Well, that's true for Tennessee. At least when I lived there, it was true for Chattanooga because of it became sort of a way station for the gangs coming up from Miami. And that's why Nooga became such a hotbed for a while. I don't know if it still is.
This gets back to the black budget.
Yeah.
Because again and again, when you see a group of sort of soccer moms organized to back the drugs out of their neighborhood, they run into the Linda Ives problem, which is, James Bond is protecting the drug lines, and it's so centralized that one neighborhood can't clean it up.
Well, let's talk about the black budget then in greater detail. For the sake of definition, the black budget is the actual amount of money that never appears in an auditable form for the U.S. taxpayer, or for that matter, the majority of people in the U.S. government.
U.S. government. Remember, a law was passed in the Bush administration requiring audited financial statements. The federal government has never complied, ever. So we don't have audited financial statements at the federal government.
There are books that come out every year that say this is how much this agency has to spend and this is how much that agency will have to spend.
Right.
We have that.
Let me give you some idea of the magnitudes. And I looked it up for Minnesota because I know you live in Minnesota.
There you go.
When I did these figures, the April 2000 census said that there were 4,919,479 people living in Minnesota, residents.
Okay.
They paid $42.8 billion in IRS individual taxes, not corporate, just individual. And that meant their taxes per resident in 99 were $8,694.
Okay.
And in the following year, the proposed appropriations to federal agencies without reliable financial systems or audits per resident was $7,506.
I think you lost me on that last one. What did that mean?
So if I live in Minnesota and I'm paying $8,694 a year on average taxes per resident, And of that amount, about 80%, 84%, $7,506 is going to agencies that do not have reliable financial systems or audits. Then the majority of the money I'm paying into the government is going down a hole. As of 2001, if you looked at the amount of money missing, undocumentable adjustments in the last 4 years, it was $14,000 per resident. So say for the average household in Minnesota, that's about $50,000 per household is missing in 4 years from the federal government.
And we say missing, but very likely it's being used for what?
Well, that's the $64 question. In 1997, when I gave a presentation to a group of pension fund leaders, we talked about this the last time, and described sort of my vision of how we could radically improve productivity and protect the middle class in the United States. And the head of the largest pension fund in the country said to me, "You don't understand, it's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out in the fall." And that's when the money started to go. That fall was when the money started to go missing from the federal government. So, I think part of the question is, have we seen a situation where tremendous debt has been issued, including off-balance sheet, and that money has then been shifted to invest abroad? Because I don't think whatever it is, it's just in sort of black budget items. I think we're looking at a significant reengineering of how the planet and assets on this planet is governed. I think essentially what you're watching is the reengineering of government. We're shifting control and ownership of assets out of governments and into corporate and private investment hands, and shifting towards a one-world government. But that one-world government is really, a governance system where corporations rule, not governments.
A corporatocracy. Let's tie that back into the first conversation we had about your experience when somebody came up to you within the government and said, "Do you want to meet an alien? Do you want to have lunch with an alien?" Could it be that somehow all of those stories are tied together?
Well, it could be, but I've worked my whole life in business or government, and what I've watched for that whole time is steadily growing organized crime and a steadily deteriorating culture. And the reality is you can't, what you've got is a group of people who are using invisible weaponry and technology and sort of, secret societies, and they're running the world in a very different way than the rest of us think the world works. And, you sort of got these, I'm grossly oversimplified, two cultures, sort of insiders and outsiders. And the insiders get more and more bold and more and more bold. Where does it go? And I think part of it is for 5,000 years, we've had, the English-speaking people or the European people, whatever you want to describe it, our predominant model has been warfare. And it's been a very successful model. I call it the sort of central banking warfare model. We print money, and then we have a military that gets everybody to take it. And when we need subsidies to keep the model propped up, we just, steal land and kill people. And it's worked. But the reality is we're coming into the end game because we have, significant. We're globalizing. We have very sophisticated technology. We've got 6 billion people. And that model can't, if we're going to live in this planet in harmony, that model can't continue without getting very ugly.
If just the average schmo wrote that to me in an email, I'd say they were crazy. But when you say it, it sounds totally convincing. It's Catherine Austin Fitz. We'll pick it up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. If you are looking for the rest of the information for so many of these coast-to-coast story threads, which you hear all the time with George or on Sunday nights with whomever it is that's hosting or with me on Saturday, remember to get the After Dark newsletter where we do a lot of follow-ups, 1-888 727-5505. You can find out more at coasttocoastam.com. You'll join the conversation coming up next hour with the former Reagan administration era economist, Catherine Austin Fitz. And we're talking about the black budget. We're talking about other things she has learned since she's been in government about how the government works. And I want to take another stab at tying all the conversations in together. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Hey, Catherine Austin Fitz, have you ever heard the theory that one of the causes behind the Protestant Reformation was the discovery of the New World?
No, I have not.
The thought is that the two events are connected, the 1492 adventures of Columbus and the popularization of this whole new world that existed out in the ocean, and the fact that the Catholic Church of the early 16th century became destabilized with people who were willing to question authority, saying, look, you never said that it was there.
Well, I thought it was the printing press.
Well, you have Gutenberg's Bible comes along in it, but it isn't that originally.
Well,
I mean,
Leif Erikson and the Scandinavians were in North America way before Columbus.
Sure, but it wasn't popularized. And the thought is that the question became, and we'll never really know because we don't have surveys to back it up, and there wasn't a lot of popular discussion of it, but there's just this thought that that was such a ground-shaking kind of event, that there was this whole new world, and that there was already people were thinking about going there, and that the church had never told people that it was there, that they think that maybe there's something to that. The reason I bring that up is I think about what would happen, and since the very first conversation we started to have tonight was about the approach that had come to you about being involved in a committee meeting about talking about what would happen if the American people knew that aliens were living amongst us. And I think the question is, would it shake the earth? Would it make it, would it so mess up everything that it would be in the government's best interests to keep that information away from the public so that the money keeps flowing either down this black hole that you talk about or to the corporatocracy that is behind the government, that it would ruin the consumer, or it would freak people out too much that the economy would never be the same again and they'd stop being able to siphon off as much money as they have. Any thought on that?
I think that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the reality is if a group of people can get away with something and it's to their advantage in terms of power and money to get away with it, then they will. And we're in a situation, irregardless of what the truth is, where essentially the crowd is not able or willing to enforce good behavior. Another way to say it is the crowd supports the criminals. So we have a situation where literally a relatively small group of people can get away with murder. And the question is for the rest of us is, what do we do about it?
Well,
I think that the problem is you've got a real imbalance of power going on in our culture and in our society.
Well, I just wonder what would happen. I mean, to go back to that original conversation, I wonder what would happen if the American people were told, okay, yeah, by the way, there's aliens everywhere.
And
nobody cared. And nobody cared. Everybody was like, oh, cool, let me see the ship and show me your ray gun and like, oh, neat, can you make that vaporize? And I mean, and they actually didn't care. And I wonder what would happen and whether or not there is whether there really is an effort.
Here's the problem. You know, I don't know that aliens do exist.
Right.
I don't know that. In my personal experiences with good old-fashioned organized crime and government corruption.
Right.
So my personal experience is pretty mundane. You know, it's clear that we don't, it's unnerving. We all live on a planet, and it is clear from the information we do have that we don't have a good map of what's happening and why. We don't have a good picture of our reality. We go to school and spend, you know, enormous amounts of years in a school, and we don't get an accurate map of our world. And I think we all find it terribly unnerving. But the reality is we don't know what's going on, and it's clear. Well, I mean, I don't think there is a government. I worked at the highest levels of government, and what I saw was the Wild West. I didn't see a government as people, you know, as you see when you watch TV.
Right.
It was, it was warfare. It was economic warfare, and it was, it was scary because it wasn't always particularly adult.
Is the hedge against that gold?
Well, I think there are many different things that a person can do to protect themselves and their assets. And the first and most important is family and community. When the litigation started, it turned out, I counted it up, I had lent $250,000 to friends and family, and that was the source of money that the Department of Justice and sort of the situation could never shut off. And if it hadn't been for that money coming back, I wouldn't be alive today. And so, friends and family turned out to be a much better investment than gold or anything could possibly have been. So I would say friends and family are first. The second best investment, I would say, is to get your overhead way, way down. And the more you can build your skills and your network to be self-sufficient, the better. I'm a person who used to have a very high personal and professional overhead, and now I operate at a much lower overhead because that's really freedom. Anything you can do to get your debt down as well is terrific. And then finally, there's no doubt about it, precious metals are a great way of protecting your assets, and it's also really a vote for freedom, because one of the biggest issues, we've been watching very significant inventories of gold moved out of private, out of governments and out of central banks into private hands, and I'm assuming that it's being accumulated and stockpiled for the purpose of going to, you know, regional currencies and then one world government and currency. And so one of the greatest votes for freedom I think anybody can make is to buy silver and gold and keep that inventory decentralized.
Yeah,
but as we've seen the price of gold skyrocket over the last couple of years, it's really not gold that's changing in value. That is a sign of the dollar dropping in value.
Well, I don't want to be a fearmonger, but if you're right when you say that it is only because of the military that the dollar has value, then wouldn't it be in the best interest of the government to at some point just merely confiscate the gold or invalidate anybody else's private use of it?
Well, when confiscation happened in the 30s, gold was a very significant part of the personal wealth of Americans. Now it's unfortunately de minimis. And so if you confiscated gold, you would confiscate from the most noisy, irascible part of the population, and you get very little. The more likely thing to be confiscated is capital controls and 401k plans, but it would be very subtle. We've seen over the last 10 years, you know, enormous, and 20 years, but really last 10 years, enormous restrictions placed on investment flows for Americans, and I deal regularly with sort of investment options available to Americans and then investment options available to people outside the country. And Americans have significantly poorer investment options and choices than a non-American or, say, a European. And that's because you've seen very, very subtle rules and regulations that all pile up, really come up to capital controls. I'm a member of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, which is a group of people who've lobbied and tried to educate against the suppression of the gold price and the manipulation of the precious metals markets. And one of the things that we are in the process of doing is trying to find out what has happened to the inventories of gold in the government, and really trying to stop the kind of manipulation of the gold market. In the process, we wrote a letter to Treasury and said to them, you know, would you confiscate? And they wrote back and said, we reserve the right and power to confiscate not just gold, but all assets. If you go to our website at GATA.org, GATA.org, you can see that letter up on the GATA website.
Naomi Wolf is a popular writer, and she is most often known for, I think, for kind of being left of center on social and political views. So I'm not sure what to do with this other than just to, you know, stipulate that up front. But I was talking to a friend who watched a video that she has on YouTube in which she says that right now the United States is almost in the exact place that the Weimar Republic was in before Adolf Hitler. That we are...
Well, what you're watching is, and this is where the Weimar Republic, you know, it's not an inappropriate comparison. You were watching a country trying to inflate out of its debt problems, and as that happened, you got a skyrocket in the value of real assets. You get an inflation effect in the stock market, and that's kind of what we've been watching. And so it's not an inappropriate comparison. One of the people in the gold market who I think is the best commentator on what's happening in the gold market is James Turk. And I was just down at the New Orleans Precious Metals Conference and heard Turk's presentation. And he described it very much as a certain period in the Weimar Republic before it, the finances fell apart. Now, I don't see what happened there to happen here, but the reality is when your financial situation becomes this dire, the more you spend, the more you watch your freedom go away. And there's literally a correlation. I think Ron Paul's been saying this in his campaign, that, you know, the more the government spends, the more we lose our freedom.
Well, so, when Naomi Wolf says that, of course, I think we have images of people, you know, post-World War II or in Russia, you know, with giant wheelbarrows full of cash to buy a loaf of bread.
Well, the difference between the Weimar Republic and now is globalization, new technology, and globalization are very, very deflationary. And so one of the things, you know, if tomorrow we woke up and found ourselves as the central banker, one of the things you're very afraid of is an inflationary spiral, but the other thing you're afraid of is a deflationary spiral, and both are a possibility. And the, you know, the most important thing you can do in helping a family plan for the kind of uncertainty we're dealing with is to make sure whether it's a deflationary spiral or an inflationary spiral, you're fine. A deflationary spiral would look like 1929, where you go into a depression and income and expenses fall, but income, you know, falls faster. Right now, what we're looking at is, Ian, is a situation where for the average family, the incomes are falling and the expenses are rising. So it's a squeeze, and that squeeze has been protected by the increase in asset values, i.e. my home's going up, my land's going up, which has come from the debt bubble, and now that's turning. And so now we're going to see incomes falling and expenses rising. Even if we're in a deflationary spiral, because what we've got is we've got exploding populations and limited resources of certain kinds, food, water, oil, et cetera. So a great comment was the investor Jimmy Rogers, when asked if he was worried about peak oil, he said, forget peak oil, it's peak everything.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because we were just talking about, I mean, obviously the guest we're going to have on originally tonight was about water and about the Great Lakes and the number of other states. I think it was even the Democratic candidate for president, Richardson, said that that Wisconsin was awash with water, that and making it seem like these, you know, states in the upper Midwest had no right to claim, you know, all of this water, and that it should start being pumped around to the rest of the country.
One of the things that just I want to cry every time I see it. I just went through all the Minnesota pension funds this morning to see where they were invested. You literally see the big pension funds and everybody's 401k in a state financing, you know, the big banks. They're buying stock in the big banks at the same time that private corporations are moving in and buying up their farmland and their water. The best investment we can make in a county or a state, the state pension funds, is to lock up that water and that farmland, because that's what's going to have real value. So we're crazy to, you know, to be investing in large corporations and let the most precious assets we need get bought out from under us.
Well, and how do you do that? How do you buy a lake? I mean, what do you mean by that? I'm not. How should we invest in? Let's say you have a county in Minnesota where there's, you know, 10,000 hockey rinks. What do you do with that? That's what we call
it
here in Minnesota.
Well, it depends on how the water and land is owned now. But for example, there's a town in California, Mount Shasta, which is famous for its water.
Right.
And they're having a huge squabble because Nestle's been running around the country buying up, you know, all the spring water and different areas with special water and water, you know, spring water companies. And they're having a big fight because Nestle's gotten what appears to be a fantastic, a below market price, good for 100 years, in a structure where apparently, according to the town, if they run short of water, Nestle gets the water and the townspeople don't get the water, which is a very serious issue because, you know, we now have a town in Tennessee that has literally run out of water. Our drought was so bad this summer.
I heard about that a little bit. That was that kind of a small town, but
right.
But the mayor was on Good Morning America or something talking about that. I caught a little bit of it. So buying it, I mean, getting together and buying resources means, you know, that you keep it from being sold to somebody else, that you make sure that it's fully funded.
Right. Okay. Well, in 19, you asked why the enemy of the state happened to me and my company. We were putting together venture funds, and we're prototyping venture funds whereby communities could raise capital and finance themselves in doing a variety of different things. One is to provide liquid equity capital to the small local businesses so that they didn't have to finance with debt, because one of the primary, the chief competitive advantage of large corporation is they can finance in the stock market with liquid equity and small businesses can't. So our theory was, if you could have a publicly traded venture fund for your community that could finance privatizations of these kind, like water, small businesses, we would create a stock that literally could go up if the popsicle index went up.
Right.
Because literally, if I have a publicly traded stock for my community and I improve the environment or I improve energy self-sufficiency or I improve the popsicle index, the stock will go up. And so we can create an incentive system where the well-being of the people and the life in a place is aligned with the finance, and both local and global investors can make money making that place wonderful and sort of healing whatever problems are in that place. And in fact, that's how I first came to the Popsicle Index, because when I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing, I was told we had a $320 billion portfolio, and I was told by the Office of Management and Budget that we were bankrupt. So I did a sort of a crash actuarial analysis to figure out what would cause us to get unbankrupt, and it turned out a rising Popsicle Index. So there's tremendous correlation between the financial performance of the equity and assets in a place and the Popsicle Index, believe it or not.
No, I believe that. Confidence in the economy is a palpable force. Well, that's where we'll suspend this conversation, this part of it, but we'll come back to what you want to ask Catherine Austin Fitz next on Coast to Coast AM.